You are listening to Blessed and Bossed Up, presented by Anchored Media, an entrepreneurship podcast for Christians all about how to make God the CEO of your business. Get ready to be inspired, challenged, but well-equipped to live and build your destiny His way. Hey guys, welcome to another episode of the Blessed and Bossed Up podcast, and happy March. It is Women's History Month, International Women's Day, so shout out to all of the women who are making it happen, building businesses, growing your families, serving the Lord. Shout out to all of you because you deserve to be celebrated. Today, we are going to continue on with our book club pick, The Ruthless Elimination of Hurry by John Mark Comer. If you haven't started reading it yet, please go ahead and get the book. I'll read an overview in a second, but the link for the book will be in the show notes. We only read one chapter so far, so I think I did the prologue and then the first chapter, and we're going to cover two chapters today. So you still have time to catch up. The book is broken up into three sections. And so today we'll be finished with part one. It is a quick read. It's an easy read, but it's powerful. Every chapter is meaty. It's not one of those books where you got to sift through a lot of fluff to get to the point. Every sentence means something. And I love that about the book. Quick description. It says, "Who am I becoming?" That was the question nagging pastor and author John Mark Comer. Outwardly, he appeared successful, but inwardly, things weren't pretty. So he turned to a trusted mentor for guidance and heard these words: "Ruthlessly eliminate hurry from your life. Hurry is the greatest enemy of the spiritual life." It wasn't the response that he expected, but it was and continues to be the answer he needs. Too often, we treat the symptoms of toxicity in our modern world instead of trying to pinpoint the cause. A growing number of voices are pointed at hurry or busyness as a root of much evil. Within the pages of this book, you'll find a fascinating roadmap to staying emotionally healthy and spiritually alive in the chaos of the modern world. I wanted to read this book because I've read it a few years ago and I felt like I needed to revisit it. I'm somebody who has a busy lifestyle generally because family, business, school, all the things. But I also have a very busy internal life. What I got to do next? I need to hurry up and do this. I hate being late. So sometimes I have to rush and all of that. And so I knew that I needed to revisit this book for myself. And I suspect, because we see each other over here, that many of you needed to either revisit it or visit it for the first time as well. So we already covered the prologue as well as chapter one. And so in this episode, we are going to read chapter two and three. In chapter two, he gives us a history of speed and how in the world we got to this point where everything is so freaking fast. He started off by giving a history, how we used to go or operate our days with the natural rhythm of the day. When the sun came up, we will wake up. When the sun started to set, we would wind down and go to sleep. And that was just the natural flow of people's days. It was slow. It was in sync with the natural rhythm of the day. And now we have alarm clocks that jolt us out of whatever phase of sleep we may be in at any given point in time, and has forced us to conform to this artificial timeline to accommodate 9 to 5, working all day, all year long. Because even when we were going by waking when the sun comes up and sleeping when the sun goes down, that changed. We have daylight savings time. So the winter, it will be dark a little bit longer. You get a little bit more rest. The summer is a little bit more sun. So you were waking up earlier. Like, you would really be able to flow with the natural rhythm of the day. And now we are forced to conform with this artificial time. I even feel my body in conflict with that often because I'm somebody who's an early riser. If I was to stay asleep in the morning, I would have to have blackout curtains. I could not even feel that the sun is close to being up. because once the sun wakes up, my body naturally is like, okay, now it's time to wake up. And I'm an early bird as well. So I'm naturally going to wake up on the earlier side. But especially if I see the sun is up, my body is like, okay, we have to be awake. I'm not somebody that could like sleep the day away, wake up at 2 or 3, like I can't. Once the sun starts going down, I start winding down. And maybe that's because I am an early bird, that I also am somebody who goes to bed earlier. But my body, I feel, naturally flows that way. And when I'm awakened by my alarm clock, I'm more likely to be grouchy, groggy, because I didn't naturally wake up. I was essentially slapped in the face and told to get up by this aggressive alarm clock. Or I might force myself to sleep by a certain time so I could get a decent amount of sleep before that alarm clock is going to go off. And so it feels, for a lot of us, counterintuitive the way that the world is. But unfortunately, that's the way the world is. So how do we continue to live our life and understand the world that we live in, but we're not of the world that we're living in? That we understand that, okay, I have to set an alarm to wake up. I have to do X, Y, Z, but I'm refusing to get swept up in that pace. How do we maintain our internal pace, our own steadiness and foundation in a world that's so busy? And that's why we're reading this book. But nevertheless, he goes on to say how in 1879, you had Edison and the light bulb, which made it possible to stay up past sunset. He said, okay, brace yourself for this next stat. Before Edison, the average person slept 11 hours a night. Can y'all imagine sleeping for 11 hours at night? I average about 6 to 8. Closer to 6, depending on what I have going on, closer to 8. If things are a little bit slower. But 11, that sounds amazing. That sounds absolutely amazing. He said, I used to read biographies of great men and women from history who got up to pray at 4 o'clock in the morning. I would think, wow, they're way more serious about Jesus than I am. True, but then I realized that they went to bed at 7 o'clock. After 9 hours of sleep, what else was there to do? Now, at least in America, we're down to 7 as the median number of hours of sleep per night. That's 2.5 hours less sleep than just a century ago. He says, Harvard Business Review recently conducted a study on the change in social status in America. It used to be that leisure was a sign of wealth. People with more money spent their time playing tennis or sailing in the bay or sipping white wine during lunch at the golf club. But that's changed. Now, busyness is a sign of wealth. You see this cultural shift in advertising, commercials and magazine ads for luxury items like a Maserati or a Rolex used to show the rich sitting by the pool in the south of France. Now, they're more likely to show the wealthy in New York or downtown LA leading a meeting from a high-rise office, going out for late-night drinks at a trendy club, or traveling the world. A century ago, the less you worked, the more status you had. Now it's flipped. The more you sit around and relax, the less status you have. He says, not surprisingly, over the same time period, we've seen the death of the Sabbath in American life. Until the 1960s, and in some places as recently as the 90s, blue laws forced businesses to close on the Sabbath, a government-mandated speed limit on the pace of American life. My dad is pushing 70, and he tells stories about growing up in the Bay Area in the 50s and how the entire city was shut down at 6 on the weekends and all day Sundays. Nothing was open but the church. Nobody went out to brunch or to a sports game, much less shopping. Can you imagine that happening in Silicon Valley today? I can't. My dad still talks about what a big deal it was when 7-Eleven came to town, the first chain store to stay open 7 days a week and until 11 p.m. In one generation, Sunday evolved from a day of rest and worship to a day to buy more crap we don't need, run errands, eat out, or just get a jump start on our work for the week ahead. I thought this was so interesting because a lot of people, Sunday is your planning day. That's where you prepare for the week. During football season, you'll be in church and they'd be like, okay, we got to get out before the game start because football games are on Sundays. Like, what? How are we rushing worshiping the Lord to go and watch a football game? How are we so focused on productivity and what we need to get done and accomplish that instead of spending a day to just simply rest and worship the Lord, we're spending it in our planners. We're spending it doing work around the house. We're spending it doing all of these other things. We're quote unquote resetting, but we're resetting everything except for what matters the most, which is our focus and attention on the Lord. Isn't that something? Let's sit with that for a second. Instead of resting and worship, we have to be productive, which insinuates that rest and worship are not productive. So I would challenge you to really sit with your perspective of productivity. Really sit with what productivity means to you, not just in what you think or how you feel, but what your actions show. Do you feel most productive when you are getting things done? And I'm using air quotes. Do you feel lazy or less productive if you're resting or worshiping or spending time in your word? Are you one of those people who just can't sit down? I would challenge you to really investigate that and sit with the Lord about that so that he can reveal some things to you. Because as we'll see shortly, I think in the next chapter when we get into it, most of the time that's rooted somewhere and it's rooted in something that we need to surrender to the Lord so that he can deliver us from it. The author goes on to say, we lost more than a day of rest. We lost a day for our souls to be open to God. He said it, and in 2007, drum roll, the year Steve Jobs released the iPhone into the wild. It was also a few months after Facebook opened up to anybody with an email address, the year a microblogging app called Twitter became its own platform. Year one of the cloud, along with the App Store. The year Intel switched from silicon to metal chips to keep Moore's Law on a roll, and a list of other technological breakthroughs, all right around 2007, the official start date of the digital age. A recent study found that the average iPhone user touches his or her phone 2,617 times a day. Each user is on his or her phone for 2.5 hours over 76 sessions. And that's all smartphone users. Another study on millennials put the number at twice that. In every study I read, most people surveyed had no clue how much time they actually lost on their phones. If you have an iPhone, you can go and look right now and see how much time a day you spend on your phone. It tells you. He says a similar study found that just being in the same room as our phones, even if they're turned off, will reduce someone's working memory and problem-solving skills. Translation, they make us dumber. As one summary of the report put it, if you grow dependent on your smartphone, it becomes a magical device that silently shouts your name at your brain at all times. And I can definitely attest to that. I get migraines from time to time, unfortunately. And one of the things that makes it worse is screens. And whenever I will find myself sometimes, if I have a migraine and maybe I took something, I'm laying down, and let's say it's because a lot of times it's on one side of my head, I will like close that eye. And this is so terrible. I will close that eye that is on the side of my head that is hurting the most and use the other eye to continue to be on my phone. Because if I use the eye on the side that's hurting, it's going to make it worse. Like, that is sad. But, and I recognize that and be like, this is ridiculous. And I like put the phone somewhere and just like close my eyes, cut on some music or something to just, you know, help me relax until the migraine goes away. But our phones are that addictive.
This episode is brought to you by IXL. The final stretch of the school year is here,
With projects, report cards, end of the year milestones approaching, IXL helps kids stay focused, confident, and ready to finish strong. IXL is an award-winning online learning platform that helps kids truly understand what they're learning, whether they're building math confidence, strengthening reading and writing skills, or reviewing science concepts. From pre-K through 12th grade, with personalized interactive content that adapts to each child's level and pace, it's an easy way to support learning now, through summer, and into next school year. Y'all know, we've said it month after month, I am an IXL girl. We use it every single day in my house. Right now, my kindergartner is getting ready for a new standardized test, and their testing software that his school uses actually integrates with IXL. And so he's able to use IXL for his specific level to get him ready for his upcoming exams. IXL is proven to improve grades. Studies show that kids who use IXL score higher on tests, and that's actually proven in all 50 states. It saves you time and money. One subscription covers everything, pre-K through 12th grade for all the kids in your home. Make an impact on your child's learning and get IXL now. And Blessed and Bossed Up listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXL.com/today. Visit IXL.com/today to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price. This episode is brought to you by Built. Now, whether you're renting or paying a mortgage, one of your biggest monthly expenses should be working harder for you. That's where Built comes in. Built is a membership for where you live that rewards you with points on every housing payment, wherever you live. Built started out rewarding members on their rent. Now, as of 2026, Built members can also earn points on mortgage payments wherever they live. Every housing payment earns you points that you can use towards flights with top travel partners like United and Hyatt, Lyft rides, Amazon.com purchases, and so much more. Personally, I'm redeeming my points for some trips. It's summertime. It's warm outside. She's trying to be outside. She's trying to be on these flights, okay? But here's what I think is the most underrated part. Built members also get access to a neighborhood concierge, meaning it can make restaurant reservations, book fitness classes, and find new local spots, all while being rewarded at more than 45,000 merchant partners. It's like having a personal assistant baked into where you live. It's simple. Being a renter and now owning a home is better with Built. Join a membership for where you live at joinbuilt.com/blessed. That's joinbuilt.com/blessed. Make sure you use our URL so they know that we sent you. This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. I want to remind you guys that May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and this is a great opportunity to check in with yourself and understand where you are right now. I know for me, I am wrapping up my first year of law school, and I definitely am taking a moment to check in with myself after such a crazy year. If you have been feeling overwhelmed, stuck, anxious, or even unsure, acknowledge that. And I want you to know that those feelings are more common than we think, and we don't have to navigate them alone. BetterHelp has quality therapists. They work according to a strict code of conduct and are fully licensed in the U.S. BetterHelp does the initial matching work for you so you can focus on your therapy goals. You have a short questionnaire that helps identify your needs and preferences, and with their 12-plus years of experience and industry-leading match fulfillment rate, that means that they typically get it right the first time. And if you aren't happy with your match, you can just switch to a different therapist at any time from their tailored recommendations. With over 30,000 therapists, BetterHelp is the world's largest online therapy platform, helping serve over 6 million people globally. And it works, with an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 stars for live sessions based on over 1.7 million client reviews. You don't have to be on this journey alone. Find support and have someone with you in therapy. Sign up and get 10% off at BetterHelp.com. That's Better, H-E-L-P.com. He goes on to say that Sean Parker, the first president of Facebook, now calls himself a conscientious objector to social media. In an interview with Axios, he begrudgingly admitted, "God only knows what it's doing to our children's brains. the thought process that went into building these applications, Facebook being the first of them, was all about how do we consume as much of your time and conscious attention as possible. And that means that we need to sort of give you a little dopamine hit every once in a while because someone liked or commented on a photo or a post or whatever. And that's going to get you to contribute more content, and that's going to get you more likes and comments. It's a social validation feedback loop, exactly the kind of thing that a hacker like myself will come up with, because you're exploiting a vulnerability in human psychology. He says, I use the italics, but in moments like these, we see behind the curtain of what my friend Mark Sayers calls digital capitalism. Economists call it the attention economy. Harris calls it an arms race for people's attention. A company can get your money if and only if they can get your attention. And we see this play out every single day on social media. We see this play out in influencer culture. The reason why influencer culture is what it is and these people get all of these brand deals and all of that is because these individuals, creators, have figured out how to get people's attention. And so brands pay them to get in front of the eyes that they have cultivated. That's it. Marketing has always gone back to just that. Before the digital age, where Nike would sponsor, let's say, golf or basketball or whatever, they paid big money for these athletes to wear their brand because they had the attention of their sports fans. But now the digital age has just set this ablaze because we still have people who are able to sell to their audience, right? But you also have these devices in and of themselves, these platforms that make room for the people to sell to their audience. So for example, you have, let's say, the influencer who a brand will pay because the influencer has amassed a certain amount of following. The brand will pay them to advertise to their audience. But the platform that the influencer has built their audience on is created to be addictive, both for the influencer so that they can continue to do the things that is getting people on their platform and engaged, but also to everybody else, making us addicted to being on their platforms so that we can continue to give our attention to them. So the influencer gets paid to sell directly to the audience that they have amassed, but then the platform, because they're also capitalizing off of your attention, are able to have their own built-in ads and things to target you. And we see it. I mean, you could open up TikTok right now. You got the people who are live doing these QVC type of selling. You have, and TikTok took it to a whole nother level because they have buying right within their platform, which is quite brilliant in my opinion. But you scroll and you'll see people who are live selling stuff. Then you'll see people who are just selling whatever because they can link it to the TikTok shop and get a little commission. Then you see an ad that's directly from the brand itself. It is crazy. The attention economy now is insane. And in some ways, I don't think that it's all wrong, because I mean, obviously this is a major issue, the ways in which these platforms are addictive. But I like that a regular everyday person can build a community based upon whatever it is their message is. Maybe it's showing a happy family. Maybe it's showing their school journey. Maybe it's them sharing fashion and beauty and all of that. I think that it is amazing the opportunity that's provided for a regular everyday person to build community and then be able to build a lifestyle and a life for themselves based upon building community. I think that it's wonderful that the everyday person can come on and say, hey, I bought this juicer or whatever from the TikTok shop and I love it. And now I'm telling you about it. And if you buy it, I get a kickback. We go and tell people about stuff we buy from stores all the time. We ask our friends and family, oh, where did you get this from? All the time. And so the fact that people could now get paid for their recommendations, I think that that's great. That puts food in their mouth, gas in their car. It helps feed their family. I think that that's wonderful. I also think it's great that a brand can go on these social platforms and sell their products and be able to target specifically who needs the products. You know, once things get predatory, that's when I have a problem with it. But when everybody's happy, one side is getting a need met, one side is getting paid, I think it's great. When regular everyday people are able to elevate their life financially based off of something that they want to do anyway, I think that that's great. However, we have to also still recognize when something is keeping us away from the one that matters most, and that is the Lord. And so in all of the ways in which these situations or platforms can be positive, we can't ignore how detrimental this digital age can be to our relationship with God overall, in our time and ability and mental capacity to be able to really sit with Him. The author even goes on to say that psychologists make the point that the very mass majority of Americans' relationship to their phones falls at least under the category of compulsion. We have to check that last text, click on Instagram, open that email, etc. But most of us are past that to full-on addiction. He says, if you think you're the exception to the rule, great, prove it. How? Turn off your phone for 24 hours straight, just one day, and call it a digital Sabbath. I highlighted this because I was like, I think I want to do this. I don't have, like, I already don't have Instagram on my phone at all. I don't, definitely don't have Facebook on my phone. I have TikTok on my phone. I use it to reference things if I'm searching for something, restaurants and things like that. So I keep it on my phone for those purposes. But I can't lie. Once I'm on there, the algorithm knows me. So I'm just cackling and scrolling. But that's the only social network that's on my phone. And my phone also has no notifications. The only notifications that come through are my bank, my texts, of course, and phone calls. But outside of that, I don't have any social media on my phone, and definitely except for TikTok, the notifications are definitely off. And I don't even post on there to even get notifications about any likes or whatever. And I only see when people tag me and things. Shout out to everybody who listens to this podcast and you post TikToks and tag me. I always see those, and I love to see those. But yeah, I don't have social media on my phone. My notifications are off. I do get the ones from my bank and ones from school, because a lot of times things are, time is of the essence when I have emails and things from professors and things at school. But yeah, I think that that is very helpful for me in staying out of addiction territory. But again, I still get drawn in. I might be thinking about something. I might look it up. And that's where my relationship with my phone can be a bit much, where I'm somebody who's always thinking ahead. My brain goes to 50 million places. I'm always having an idea for something, and then I'm on my phone. I think, oh, I want to take the kids here, and I start looking stuff up. Or what if I did this with the podcast, and I start going down the deep dives? And that's still distracting. Even if it's not scrolling on social media, it's still distracting. And so I'm like, maybe I can do this 24-hour Sabbath. Let me know if you are on Spotify. Put it in a comment. If you are on YouTube, put it in a comment. If you're listening to this wherever you listen to podcasts, find me and let me know if you want to do this. I'm thinking maybe we can do this in the society and just do like 24 hours. That's it. We turn our phones off. Maybe if you have like kids or families, people that you care for that need to get in touch with you, spend that 24 hours with them to where you are physically around them and they don't have to call you, and cut your phone off and see what happens. I don't know. I'm thinking about doing this for myself as well as for us as a community. More to come. I'll keep you posted. Now, in the next chapter, we take a break from talking about technology and just going deeper into the negative impacts of hurry. So this is all in, again, part one of the book, really putting a magnifying glass to the issue. And then in part two, he starts talking more about the solution. And that's what we'll pick up for the next episode. But in this chapter, the title is called Something is Deeply Wrong. He says, psychologists and mental health professionals are now talking about an epidemic of the modern world, hurry sickness. as in they label it a disease. Here is one definition of hurry sickness: a behavior pattern categorized by continual rushing and anxiousness. Here's another: a malaise in which a person feels chronically short of time and so tends to perform every task faster and to get flustered when encountering any kind of delay. Meyer Friedman, the cardiologist who rose to fame for theorizing that type A people who are chronically angry and in a hurry are more prone to heart attacks. He defined it as a continuous struggle, an unremitting attempt to accomplish or achieve more and more things or participate in more and more events in less time. Friedman was the one who originally coined the phrase hurry sickness after noticing that most of his at-risk cardiovascular patients displayed a hurrying sense of time urgency. And take a deep breath, he said this in the 50s. Anybody feel convicted yet? Or is it just me? He says, how do you know if you have this up-and-coming disease? It's straightforward. Rosemary Sward and Philip Zimbardo, authors of The Time Cure, offer these symptoms of hurry sickness. Moving from one checkout line to another because it looks shorter and faster. Counting the cars in front of you and either getting in the lane that has the least or is going the fastest. Multitasking to the point of forgetting one of the tasks. Let me tell you, one of my rules to help not rush, something that I've started to do because I hate being late. Fun fact, being late drives me crazy. I told y'all this in previous episodes, but unfortunately, when it's not just me getting out this house, late is just a part of the game. Unfortunately, we would literally have to get ready the day before we can get all five people out this house. And nobody in my house moves with a sense of urgency except for me. So it can be very stressful for me. So something that I started doing is once I recognize that I'm rushing and I recognize that hurry is coming up, I pause and say, you know what? I'm just going to be late. And I literally have to tell myself that, like, girl, we just going to be late. Accept it so that you could slow down. You trying to move off fast, we still going to be late. So now you're going to be late and stressed versus just late. So let's just focus on being late. And that helps me so much because now I'm not rushing. So usually I'll text if somebody is waiting for us, hey, we'll be there at this time. So that allows me to reset so that I'm not in this hurry. The author goes on to say, let's take a little self-inventory. He says, here are my 10 symptoms of hurry sickness. Check the symptom if the symptom rings true for you. Number one, irritability. You get mad, frustrated, or just annoyed way too easily. Little normal things irk you. People have to tiptoe around your ongoing low-grade negativity, if not anger. Word of advice from a fellow eggshell expert: to self-diagnose, don't look at how you treat a colleague or a neighbor. Look at how you treat those closest to you, your spouse, children, roommate, etc. Now, little advice for my moms out there, especially moms with little children. I don't really deal with irritability at baseline, but it can be overstimulating sometimes when you have like kids be allowed, you're maybe in the middle of something, somebody's calling you, needing you every single second. It could get overstimulating real quick. And when that you're overstimulated, that irritability can come up. Something that I started doing that is helpful is if my kids are like, if I feel myself getting to the point of being irritable and my kids are constantly calling me, or let's say somebody's having a tantrum or whatever, I usually just give them a hug. And it calms everybody down, including me, where we just hug and take some deep breaths. They calm down, I calm down. We reset our central nervous systems together, and then we can proceed in love. That helps a lot. So just a little tip for the moms, because we don't want to snap on our gifts. The second symptom, he says, is hypersensitivity. All it takes is a minor comment to hurt your feelings, a grumpy email set you off, or a little turn of events to throw you into an emotional funk and ruin your day. Minor things quickly escalate to major emotional events. Depending on your personality, this might show up as anger or nitpickiness or anxiety or depression or just tiredness. Point is, the ordinary problems of life on this side of Eden have a disproportionate effect on your emotional well-being and relational grace. You can't seem to just roll with the punches. Number 3, restlessness. When you actually do try to slow down and rest, you can't relax. We talked about this earlier. You give Sabbath a try and you hate it. You read scripture but find it boring. You have time with God but can't focus your mind. You go to bed early but toss and turn with anxiety. You watch TV but simultaneously check your phone, fold laundry, and get into a spat on Twitter. Okay, maybe you just answer an email. Your mind and body are hyped up on the drug of speed, and when they don't get the next dopamine fix, they shiver. Number 4. Sorry, y'all. He just take some deep breaths. If you feel like he's knocking on your door a little too much, just open it. Just open it. Number 4, workaholism or just nonstop activity. You just don't know when to stop. Or worse, you can't stop. Another hour, another day, another week. Your drugs of choice are accomplishment and accumulation. These could show up as careerism or just as obsessive house cleaning and errand running. Result? You fall prey to sunset fatigue, where by day's end, you have nothing left to give your spouse, your children, or your loved ones. They get the grouchy, curt, overtired you, and it's not pretty. Number 5, emotional numbness. You just don't have the capacity to feel others' pain, or your own pain for that matter. Empathy is a rare feeling for you. You just don't have the time for it. You live in this kind of constant fugue. Out of order, number 6, out of order priorities. You feel disconnected from your identity and calling. You're always getting sucked into the tyranny of the urgent, not the important. Your life is reactive, not proactive. You're busier than ever before, yet still feel like you don't have time for what really matters to you. Months often go by, or years, or God forbid, maybe it's been decades, and you realize you still haven't gotten around to all the things you said were most important in your life. Number 7, lack of care for your body. You don't have time for the basics, 8 hours of sleep a night, daily exercise, healthy home-cooked food, minimal stimulants, margin. You gain weight, get sick multiple times a year, regularly wake up tired, don't sleep well, live off the 4 horsemen of the industrialized food apocalypse, caffeine, sugar, processed carbs, and alcohol. Number 8, because good Lord, he came out swinging with this one. Number 8, escapist behaviors. When we're too tired to do what's actually life-giving for our souls, we each turn to our distraction of choice. Overeating, overdrinking, binge-watching Netflix, browsing social media, surfing the web, looking at porn. Name your preferred cultural narcotic. Narcotics are good, healthy even, on an occasional and short-term basis when they shield us from unnecessary pain. But when we abuse them to escape from reality, they eat us alive. Well, porn is not good at all. You find yourself stuck in the negative feedback loop of socially acceptable addictions. Number 9, slippage of spiritual disciplines. If you're anything like me, when you get over busy, the things that are truly life-giving for your soul are the first to go rather than the first to go to, such as quiet time in the morning, scripture, prayer, Sabbath, worship on Sunday, a meal with your community, and so on. Because in an ironic catch-22, the things that make for rest actually take a bit of emotional energy and self-discipline. When we get over busy, we get overtired. And when we get overtired, we don't have the energy or discipline to do what we need to do most for our souls. Repeat. The cycle begins to feed off its own energy. So instead of a life with God, we settle for a life with a Netflix subscription and a glass of cheap red wine, a very poor substitute. Not because time wasted on TV is the great Satan, but because we rarely get done binge watching anything or posting on social media or overeating Five Guys burgers and fries, etc., and feel awake and alive from the soul outward, rested, refreshed, and ready for a new day. We delay the inevitable, an emotional crash. And as a consequence, we miss out on the life-giving sense of the withness of God. Last but not least, number 10, isolation. You feel disconnected from God, others, and your own soul. On these rare times when you actually stop and pray, and by pray, I don't mean ask God for stuff. I mean sit with God in the quiet. You're so stressed and distracted that your mind can't settle down long enough to enjoy the Father's company. Same with your friend. When you're with them, you're also with your phone or a million miles away in your mind, running down the to-do list. And even when you're alone, you come to face the void that is in your soul and immediately run back to the familiar groove of busyness and digital distraction. Okay, do the math. How did you score? 7 out of 10? 8? Don't worry about it. You're not alone. Reject any guilt or shame that you feel right now is not helpful, rarely for God, and definitely not my agenda with this little exercise. The point I'm driving toward is this. An overbusy, hurried life of speed is the new normal in the Western world, and it's toxic. Psychologists tell us that anxiety is often the canary in the coal mine, our soul's way of telling us that something is deeply wrong and we need to fix it fast. In one recent study, 39% of Americans reported being more anxious than they were a year ago. That's not something to keep your eye on. It is an emotional epidemic. As my grandmother used to say, just because everybody's doing it doesn't make it smart. And as I've said before, hurry is a threat not only to our emotional health, but our spiritual lives as well. Thomas Merton once called the rush and pressure of modern life a pervasive form of contemporary violence. Violence is the perfect word. Hurry kills relationships. Love takes time. Hurry doesn't have it. It kills gratitude, joy, appreciation, and people in a rush don't have time to enter the goodness of the moment. It kills wisdom. Wisdom is born in the quiet, the slow. Wisdom has its own pace. It makes you wait for it. Wait for the inner voice to come to the surface of your mind, but not until waters of thought settle and calm. Hurry kills what we hold dear. Spirituality, health, marriage, family, thoughtful work, creativity, generosity, name your value. Hurry is a sociopathic predator in our society. I actually think that this is a good place to stop. I have a little bit more highlighted, maybe like 2 pages. But I think that the other parts that I have highlighted from this chapter are good to segue into the next part. And so part 2 of the book is all about the solution. But I think that exercise where I read out the 10 symptoms of hurry sickness, and he in the book asks you to check them off and kind of tally them up because you're listening to the show. I want you to jot down the ones that resonated the most with you. And I want you to sit with the Lord about those things. Because again, all of this is what the enemy uses to separate us from God. And we have to relentlessly seek to eliminate anything that wants to cause distance between us and the Lord. And so I think that this is a good place to pause because I think we have a lot to pray about and a lot to surrender and deal with practically. I don't want us to just read this book and be like, yes, that's good. Yes, that sounds like me, and identify with it, but not take the extra step for us to be truly delivered from it. Because we shouldn't have to read this multiple times. And I'm talking to myself. we should deal with it thoroughly and accurately. And to give me and you grace, we might have to read it again because we unfortunately live in this world and our life evolves and change and we may slip back into old habits. So even if you are revisiting, and so I'm correcting myself in real time on that, because one of my tendencies is I don't give myself enough grace. So I'm leaving this in. I'm not going to edit this out so that I could give myself grace and also give you permission to give yourself grace as well, that sometimes we do have to actually revisit things, and that's okay. And that's the benefit that we have and the grace that the Lord gives us. And that's the benefit that we have of having access to Him, that we can keep going back and allowing Him to give us wisdom on how to make better choices moving forward. So I'm going to end this episode here. Thank you guys so much for listening to another episode of the Blessed and Bossed Up podcast. I pray that this blessed you. I love you guys, and I'll see you in the next episode.